and IndieCider, where we go beyond the game and meet the developers behind today's indie hits.
Hello and welcome to the IndieCider podcast. I'm your host, Ken Gagne. This past weekend, on Sunday, March 24th, I had the pleasure of moderating a panel at PAX East 2024. The title was D-Makes Decoded, From HD to 8-Bit. Here's the official session description. In an age of HD remasters, D-Makes bucked the trend by reimagining a modern game for a more primitive console. Ever wanted to play Silent Hill 2 on the NES, Disco Elysium on Game Boy, Portal on N64, or Advance Wars on the Pico 8? Now you can. But how much of a game's core gameplay is dependent on technology? What features are important to preserve, and how do you adapt the rest? Is it really the same game? And do the original copyright owners think so? We'll chat with four D-Make devs about their projects, inspirations, and challenges, exploring how they balance modern innovation, technical constraints, and retro nostalgia. This was my first time moderating a panel since before the pandemic. The last one I did was back in 2019. The audio of that podcast was available on the IndieCider podcast, years after the podcast otherwise ended. So I'm doing the same thing here today. The audio from D-Makes Decoded was recorded and is what you are about to listen to. A full transcript of the episode can be found at indiecider.net/dmakes. Thanks so much to my four panelists, to everybody in the audience who attended the panel, and especially those who asked some great questions that you're about to hear. If you have any questions or comments about the show, feel free to visit me online at gamebits.net and fill out the form to drop me a line. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the last day of PAX East 2024. Thank you for waking up before the crack of noon to join us for D-Makes Decoded, From HD to 8-Bit. My name is Ken Gagne, pronouns he, him. Very excited to be sharing with you a panel of amazing developers today. A little bit of introduction and information before we get started. First, I want to start with a blank slide. Land acknowledgement, saying that we are residing on the ancestral and unceded lands of the Massachusetts people, whose name was appropriated by this Commonwealth. We pay respect to the Massachusetts elders, post and present. We acknowledge the truth of violence perpetuated in the name of this country and make a commitment to uncovering the truth. So this panel is about D-Makes Decoded, From HD to 8-Bit. And first, how many people here have no idea what a D-Make is? We got one person, two, three, four, five. Excellent. So for those five people, let's establish what a D-Make is. A D-Make is not Resident Evil 4. That would be a remake. We've had some amazing, wonderful, very enjoyable, and highly received and acclaimed remakes in the last few years. Resident Evil 4, Super Mario RPG, that weird game by Square that nobody thought would ever come back. And of course, Final Fantasy VII, Rebirth. Yeah. So those are all remakes. A remake is reimagining an older game for a newer system. It's not just applying a new coat of graphics like The Last of Us. It's such a technological leap that they are actually almost going back to the drawing board and making a new game inspired by the original game. A D-Make, what we're talking about today, is just the opposite. It's reimagining a newer game for an older system, going backwards in time. And we have four developers here today who I'm about to introduce. So first, who remembers Portal? Oh yeah. Yeah, Portal came out in 2007, 17 years ago, for Windows and Xbox 360. 11 years before that, the Nintendo 64 came out, and James here has ported it, Portal, has ported Portal to the N64, and this is what it looks like. James, say hello.
Yeah, hi, I'm James, James Lambert, yeah, and I ported Portal to the N64, and I guess I just repeated what he said. It took me about 2 years to get to this point, and then, the YouTube channel, if you want to check it out, you can see kind of the progress in the videos. And unfortunately, you can't get the ROM from me right now because Valve told me to take it down. But I'm sure if you searched online, you would be able to find it somewhere, but not just for me.
Yeah, it's like the Streisand effect. The more you remove it, the more visible it becomes.
Of course, yeah.
Excellent. Where are you coming in from for the panel?
Oh, yeah, I'm from Utah. That's it.
Well, thank you for coming all this way.
That's and nobody else is.
Another game that is actually going in both directions right now, a remake, is coming for Silent Hill 2, which was originally released for the PlayStation 2 in September of 2001, where, you know, speaking of James, James Sunderland is trying to find his dead wife, who he mysteriously received a letter from. And even more mysteriously, the game has been ported to the 8-bit Nintendo, called Soundless Mountain 2. And the master of that thesaurus would be Jasper Byrne here. Hello, Jasper.
Hi there. Yeah, I made this one in 2008, so it's quite a long time ago now, but it was originally for a competition for 4D makes run by the Independent Game Source, or TIG Source, where it was a forum where a lot of indies used to post back in those days. And, to my surprise, I actually won the competition. And so that actually ended up getting it noticed a little bit by, I guess, journalists and stuff. And it ended up leading on to me doing another game like Lone Survivor, which was a sort of, you know, using what I'd learned from this, if you like. So another 2D survival horror game, basically. So, yeah, it only goes up to the apartment section, but I did always want to finish it.
But all these demakes are fully playable. These aren't just tech demos, which is pretty awesome. You can actually just download them and play them. The next panelist we have is somebody who was inspired by Disco Elysium, which is a noir-style game that came out for Windows originally in October 15th, 2019. And, you know, it just seems a natural candidate, of course, to port to the original Game Boy. So we have Disco Elysium, the Game Boy edition by Colin Brannon.
Wow. Hello, everybody. Yeah, it's just like, well, it was like a pandemic project for me 4 years ago, really. I was just like trying to figure out something to work on in my spare time. I hadn't done any really creative in a few months. And there's a really neat tool out there called GB Studio, which I totally recommend anyone for making Game Boy games like this. And so this is actually completely without code. I'm an artist, not a programmer or an engineer. And yeah, so there's some really cool stuff you can do with such a small tool. And then they even let you export an actual ROM. Yeah, so people have been playing it on actual Game Boy hardware as well, which is super cool to see for me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is this your first project like this?
I've done like other small game stuff before, but this is the first thing that really got any traction or had anyone talking about it. Yeah.
Awesome.
So my first demake, yes.
That's really cool. And last but not least, another game that's also been remade, Advance Wars, originally came out for the Game Boy Advance on the same day as Silent Hill 2, September 10th, 2001, remade for the Switch in 2023, and re-remade, this is the original up there, or rather the Switch version. This is a tactical game of sorts. And it was remade by Animal Planet at the end there for the Pico 8, which is what exactly?
So it's a fantasy console, as in it takes the idea of older consoles and makes it run on modern hardware. It's all fake. No, but like it introduces fictional constraints. Is there anything else to that video, or is it just the?
Oh, sorry.
There we go. It's a game. Yeah. So it takes the Pico 8 takes ideas of making games for older consoles. You've got constraints, but all these constraints in this example are kind of artificial. It's got an artificial palette, token limit, things like that. It creates interesting constraints for making the game. And originally, I've been kind of making this game for over a decade since I started programming, because I was enamored with how artificial intelligence works for games like StarCraft and the old Advance Wars games. And I wanted to get into that and see how that really works. So it was an off and on project for very long, and I restarted it many times. Yeah, and eventually I was like, I'm making it, so.
Awesome, thank you. And then that brings us back to me. I am not a developer or an artist. I am an editor of a magazine called Juiced.gs. It's currently in its 29th year of publication. It's print only, not a PDF. And it's a magazine all about the Apple II computer. Who remembers the Apple II? Yeah, you probably remember it because you grew up playing Oregon Trail in school. Or maybe other games like Wizardry. Wizardry, the Apple II version of Wizardry, is actually on the show floor at the Atari booth. It's amazing. I'm not kidding. You can go play it. And the Apple II is originally came out in 1977, and it has been the home to many amazing demakes in the last few years, like The Secret of Monkey Island, Out of This World, also known as Another World, Myst, and these are all playable, by the way, Kerbal Space Program.
Yes.
And Portal. And those were all actually made by the same DMake artist, and he recently submitted Portal to a online competition, and when he filled out the form, they asked, what is the name of your game? And so he said, my game is called Don't Tell Valve. And we did a cover story a few years ago all about DMakes for the Apple II. I have some copies here I'll be giving out later if you want to read that. And so that is our panelists. So these are our panelists. And we're here today to talk about the DMakes that have been created that we've outlined. And I want to start with an open question to any panelists who would like to answer. And that question is, but why? why DMakes? Why? Anybody, why?
I think with Animal Planet, you mentioned constraints earlier with your response. And I think that's what it was for me, is that when you're working with a modern engine like a Unity or an Unreal, you can do anything, really. And when you're working with older hardware, you have those constraints, and that makes your project scope much smaller, and you have to really get more creative and make more interesting choices. And also, your project, you can't go forever on something. You're like, okay, I can only do so much, and it helps you keep your own, keep your projects finish. There's only so much you can do with them, which was important for me, at least.
Yeah, and along with that, with working within the constraints, I agree with everything with there, but also it's kind of fun to try to push just the at least in the N64 case, push the limits a little beyond what you think could have been done, right? See what those limits actually are, and that I really enjoy working within those those constraints and trying to push beyond what you thought was possible.
I guess I'd just add to that. Because I think some of those things apply to just making a game for an older system, but maybe also that it's trying to figure out how an existing game could work in a different visual presentation or something like that. So how do you solve the problems that were in 3D in 2D or whatever it is, you know, or through a very limited palette or whatever it is, you know. Maybe that's an aspect of it that interested me, I would say.
And one of the nice things about these platforms that have constraints is nowadays, if you want to go to, like, when I was a kid, you could grow up and go into computers, you know. But nowadays, like, you're going into graphics or networking or AI or all these other disciplines, because computers are so big, you can't grok the entire computer. With an older machine, you can be the designer and the level creator and the programmer and the sound designer, and you can do everything as just one person, like we used to do 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's nice, you know, show me somebody who did a one-man game or one-person game for PlayStation 5. That's not as likely as it was for, you know, the Pico 8 or the Apple II. How do you choose? Oh, sorry. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to maybe also say it's also interesting to look at the way mechanics have evolved and, you know, game design has evolved, and apply those things to an older system, you know, and see what it would be like, if you like, sort of thing.
Yeah, that was a big thing for me as well, is like, because I work in UI and I really want to see, like, UI has developed so much over the past like decade, especially since the RPGification of everything. And it's so complicated now, and you have so few inputs on an old Game Boy. And I was like, well, how do I take these systems and mechanics from a modern RPG and like try and crunch them down into this little machine with like, you got six buttons total plus start and select? Like, how can that work?
Yeah. Yeah. And Colin, I actually want to hear from you about the next question, which is, how do you choose which platform to demake onto? Because you took a PS4 game.
Yeah.
You could have easily remade it for PS2 or PS1 or N64, but like, what made you look at Disco Elysium and you're like, oh, that's going to be an awesome 8-bit black and white game?
Well, it was the other way, because I found the tool I used, GB Studio, first. And then I was thinking about, this seems cool, I want to make a UI-heavy game for the Game Boy. And so I had the platform first, and then I started thinking about games I've been playing recently that I really enjoyed and that had maybe interesting systems or really like contemporary ideas for like characters and leveling up and stuff. And I was like, okay, well, let's take that and apply it to that platform. So it was actually the other way around for me.
I see. Yeah. Okay. And I also want to hear from you, James, because you chose the N64 for Portal, which of the DMakes on here is the most technologically recent platform. But I want to point out that the N64 came out in September of 1996, which is closer in time to the moon landing than it is to today. So yes, it's a newer system, but not by much. So why the N64?
Actually, a lot of the same reason. I had started working on N64 homebrew games because it's the console I grew up on, and it makes me feel old hearing that moon landing thing.
But, mission accomplished.
it's the console I grew up on, and so like it kind of what inspired me to learn to make games in the first place. And so when I kind of recently discovered, well, recently being before the pandemic, discovered, hey, people are figuring out how to make games for the N64. I learned the tooling, did a few game jams, and then I was just kind of tinkering with a variety of different ideas I had, and I thought, I wonder if it'd be possible to do the portal effect, where you can render through a portal and go through it. So I thought, let's just try it, and I got it working, and I'm like, how far can I take this? And just kind of took off with it, so.
Amazing. And similarly, how do you choose the game? Like Animal Planet, you did Advance Wars, which every time I play Advance Wars, I'm like, oh, they remade Desert Commander from the 8-bit Nintendo. So like, thank you. So the mechanics of Advance Wars seem like relatively mathematically simple, and I'm saying that as not a developer. Is that something that influenced your decision to demake that game?
I would say that that was a benefit of demaking that game because fans fortunately have wikied all the aspects of combat, so I didn't have to spend weeks balancing that game. I just plugged in the numbers and there you go.
Advanced Wars it's prescriptive, right? Like you know the same action or action will always have the same outcome. Like the AI always reacts the same way, right?
Yeah, there's a little bit of randomness, okay. Especially in combat.
Okay.
And in this game, there is no randomness.
Okay.
In the Pico Wars. So there's no randomness. There's a little bit of... I fudged it a little bit, changed things a little bit, made it simpler mathematically, but ultimately, yeah. It wasn't a reason to get into it, but it was helpful.
And so when you're demaking these games, there has to be some sort of a sacrifice because it's not going to be the same game when you're done.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, Silent Hill 2, it's this psychological horror game that has a pervasive sense of the unnatural. It's not just an LJN-licensed platformer for the 8-bit Nintendo, like Back to the Future or something. So, Jasper, when you were taking Silent Hill 2, like, was that an integral aspect of Silent Hill 2 that you had to capture when making it into an 8-bit Nintendo game?
I suppose I compromised it a little bit because, I mean, technically it's not actually a Nintendo ROM. It is a PC piece of software, Soundless Mountain. So I used that to my advantage to kind of add things that couldn't be done necessarily, like transparent fog, you know, and which obviously you couldn't do on an NES. And the sound, I didn't go with pure chip tunes. I went with sort of more distorted real sounds, almost as if they were like coming out of Street Fighter 2 cabinet, you know, the sort of like the way they were crunchy and 8-bit kind of thing. So it was more trying to add a bit more realism there in the audio, I suppose, to make up for lack of detail in the visuals or something. But yeah, in effect, I cheated really with it because I didn't stick to the exact. I think it would have been difficult to do it purist on the NES because I think part of this, what makes this work or made people like it was the audio, which is quite. You know, it's quite similar to actually Silent Hill 2, but just a little bit dirtier sort of thing. So
interesting.
I think with this game, maybe it's a kind of a different case to probably the others on the panel, but because it's not actually for an old system, I mean, I made it really, my choice of why to make it for the NES was because I hadn't grown up with the NES, and it was always exotic to me, and I used to see a lot of pixel artists draw stuff in the NES palette, and I found it really attractive, but I sort of knew nothing about it, so I kind of wanted to make what I imagined an NES game would be like, if you like, having not really grown up with it.
Yeah, because survival horror was really a term coined in the PS1 era when Silent Hill and Resident Evil came out, but it could be retroactively applied to some older games like Haunted House for the Atari 2600, and I think, was it called Dear Home?
Sweet Home.
Sweet Home, thank you. The 8-bit Nintendo. So this whole genre didn't really exist predominantly in that era, and it's fascinating to see what it...
Yeah, that fascinated me about it, actually, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Now, what about Disco Elysium, Colin? So I confess I haven't played that game. I know it was at one point banned in Australia.
Oh, I hadn't heard about that.
Apparently, like just the rampant drug use.
Yeah, there's a lot of, yeah.
So when you looked at Disco Elysium, what was it you said, I need to keep this, but I can ditch this?
Okay, so there's a character in Disco Elysium named Kuno, which anyone knows. Kuno is not in my game. Kuno is a, like, 13-year-old who's the worst person you've ever met, just shouting slurs all the time and stuff. And I said, you know what? I'm already trying to contract my scope a bit. I'm sorry to all the Kuno fans out there, but I don't want to deal with this. So I was just, and then I got a bunch of messages when I put it out, and people were like, where's Kuno? Why isn't Kuno here? And I was like, sorry, I just didn't want to deal with it. But there's other stuff, like, the drug use is kind of fun, and that also, I was interested in the stats, how they work, and the drug use in the game is all about adjusting your stats. So I was like, okay, so I have to put some of that in. And that was, it was just making clever little cuts in different places. And also, another big one was, there's a lot of text in Disco Elysium. And when you're playing real Disco Elysium, you've got maybe a third of the screen is one big text scroll. Mm. On the Game Boy version, I have two lines, sometimes three, max of 18 characters. Not 18 words, 18 characters. So a big thing I didn't realize when I started is I actually had to rewrite a good portion of the script of the game so that would fit in nice little chunks that were easily parsable without having to skip through too many different sort of text boxes. Hmm.
Yeah. And is this... I'm sorry, remind me, is this the entire game you ported?
No, it's the first, I don't know how long, it depends on how you play a game, but playing this takes maybe about 40 minutes or so.
Okay.
Which is longer, I planned for 15 minutes, and then you start working, you start putting little things in there, and then luckily because it's on the Game Boy, I'm a little bit contracted to what I can do, but it's like you start putting stuff in and go, oh god, I've made a 40-minute thing here. But yeah, it's the first, it's up to the point where you solve a couple of the mysteries a little bit earlier, if you get lucky with some of the roles, so...
Are there any ways in which you think your version of this game is better than the original?
No, not really. I mean, I'm pulling so much from them, right? It's entirely derivative, I think, in a lot of ways, which is fine. I don't think that's a judge against me, but I'm taking what they're doing, going, this is really cool. What if it looked like this instead? I don't think better is really a scale that does much work for talking about comparing the two.
Okay, yeah. No, that's fair.
Yeah.
What about you, James? With Portal 64, obviously the portal mechanic is core to the game, and we saw that demoed in the video. And some of the graphic fidelity might be a little more pixelated. What other changes did you have to accept?
So with that one, I had to... the fidelity had to be dropped. There's not as much detail in many of the levels. I don't have the nice baked, like, ambient inclusion textures on the walls, and but I did try to use Portal, the original Portal, as close of a template as I could have managed for like, okay, when do I need to add details to certain places? I think this footage is a little old that you're seeing here, but you know, like the little light indicators that indicate which buttons are connected to which parts of the puzzle. I ended up adding that later, but I tried to get the important pieces in first. Like obviously the portal gun, that's important, be able to render portals through. But then as I got that, and then I said, okay, now I have the core done. Let's just start adding details as I can, and just keep iterating on that and trying to push that as far as I could. I'm trying to think if there's like what the biggest thing that I didn't get to that I was hoping I could. I know, like, being able to render multiple portals deep in, like, recursion, so you see through a portal, through a portal. I managed to do about, well, in early demos, I could go quite deep, but it was because there's very little rendering. But later on, I kind of had to stick with just, like, two layers deep, and I couldn't use some of the tricks they used for getting, pushing that further.
Yeah, so I have a quick question about that. Mm-hmm. So the portals are still really impressive when I see them in game. Like, it's just, it's really cool tech. How did you use the same tricks they use in actual Portal, or did you have to come up with your own ways to make it work on the N64?
I don't know how much I matched with what they did. I had to cater to what the N64 could do. So I think it is a little different. I kind of used tricks with the Z buffer mixed with, with partitioning the Z buffer, and I don't know how much detail I go into here. I had to use some tricks that are a little bit different there. But I mean, I guess one way to think about the portal rendering, you know, everybody knows that N64 can do split screen. Mm-hmm. So it's just split screen rendering, but within the same area. Wow. If you think about it that way, right? Like, that's kind of a way to think about it.
That's amazing. Yeah. I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, one of the other key elements of Portal, the original, is GLaDOS. So, and a lot of that comes across in the amazing voice acting. How were you able to preserve that, if at all?
Yeah, so with that, I mean, I just took the game bundle, like, if Portal has what they call VPK files, they're just these, all of the data for the game is in it. So I just made it so when you were building the ROM for Portal, you said, this is where I have that installed on my system. And it was able to extract the sound files, lower the sound quality, compress it to the N64's audio format, and then bundle it in it directly. So I didn't have to, like, include any of their assets in my project in order for it to build. It just grabbed it from theirs and changed the quality down to include it.
And let me see here. So when you're porting a game to an older system, a lot of older games we grew up with were awesome, partly because we didn't know any better. Like, and we've had a lot of quality of life improvements. Like, try playing the original Final Fantasy and stocking up on 99 potions. It takes a long time. Or trying to figure out which sword is better, this one or that one. And you have to equip them to find out, and maybe go into battle and see how much damage they do. So we've had a lot of, just the general user interface of games has improved, and the way you navigate through the world has improved. When you go back in time and demake these games, how do you avoid those paper cuts that existed back then? Or do you embrace them and just say, this is what it'd be like if this game existed back then? Yeah, it would suck. Thank goodness it didn't. No. Jasper.
I think in the case of Silent Hill 2, I couldn't honestly find much that had dated. I think it really stands up very well even today, and so I just went as hard as I could on trying to recreate every aspect. You know, like the how the menu looks, the noise when you use the menu up and down, and, you know, and kind of just all of those little details. I just tried to steal verbatim. You know, so I think. Had it, but it depends on the game, I suppose. But for me, I think that one really has held up well. It in going to 2D, it gets rid of the question of tank controls and things like that you'd have in a survival horror back then. Actually, Silent Hill 2, I think it had, well, it does have the more modern type of controls anyway, which was kind of different from Resident Evil at that time, I suppose. At least up until, well, the prior one had been Resident Evil 3, I guess, and then, but even the original Silent Hill, I think, has a camera, you know, the modern camera movement, I mean, the modern controller movement, not the tank controls, if you like. So, in that way, sense, it hadn't really dated. I mean, had it been a 3D game and doing a PS1 I guess you'd have to do a PS0 remake of like Resident Evil 1 or whatever, and it was in 3D. In that hypothetical situation, I guess you might update it to not have tank controls or something like that. But
by the way,
but then
you just inspired my PAX East 2025 panel in defense of tank controls.
Yeah, I love tank
controls.
I love them.
The tank control sickos are out there. Like,
I'm just saying, like, yeah, a D-make artist might choose to do that. But, I mean, I personally love it, so, yeah.
Same. Yeah. Thank you. Did you see that somebody, I guess this is kind of a D-make, they modified the original Super Mario Kart for the Super Nintendo to have tank controls? It's like it's fixed camera angles, and as you go around the course, the angle changes to like different static points. You know? Another D-make. Somebody ported Tears of the Kingdom's Ultra Hand to Ocarina of Time.
Right.
So, all right, just a brief aside there. Sorry. Yeah. So, Animal Planet. What about when you were porting Advance Wars? Like, are there some modern quality of life improvements to game design and UI that you were able to bring back to Pico Wars?
I think a lot of it was really nice user interface that the Advance Wars game had. I mean, they took a strategy game where you're controlling tens of units at least, and they put it on a handheld console that had just gotten color. So there's a lot of UI aspects to that. I guess, like, I really had fun. It's a weird thing, but it was a real challenge to make the arrow, so when you select a unit, you are now commanding it where to walk, and getting that arrow to look nice and to be connected in this limited system where I couldn't really, well, when there's 16 by, when it's a 16 by 16 grid for every little character, I don't know, it made it difficult to like make it even at every point. You play it, see it. It loops around pretty nicely, I think. That would be the user interface aspect that I enjoyed working on, and I don't know if I made it any cleaner, though. Like Jasper was saying, they had some good people in that game. It was more about simplifying what they already have and making it clean and fun and in a new style. And I think like the Pico 8 Fantasy Console also really shined in that regard. It made everything look really fruity, like just very colorful and vibrant and almost tropical. A Pico Wars feels like Advanced Wars on a tropical island. So.
Hmm. You know, as a magazine editor, was taught that an article isn't done when you have nothing left to add. The article is done when you have nothing left to remove. So when you say you simplified Advance Wars, did you take away some things that weren't really needed in the original and like just get rid of the cruft?
Oh yeah, there's a lot removed. It would have been really not possible to include as much as is in that game because, speaking of the constraints of the Pico 8, you only have a certain amount of code you can put for every single cartridge, they call them. And there are really hacky ways, so there's my game again. There are really hacky ways to like make it so that you can have multiple cartridges, but all the state of the game is like erased every time you switch a cartridge. So I had to write serialization code to like store it in memory and then reload it. And of course this would all be unnecessary if it was written in like Godot or something or Unity, you know, like a modern game engine. So things that had to be stripped. There are no naval units. There are no air units. Commander superpowers are unfortunately just really couldn't be fit in if the artificial intelligence is there too. But commanders do have their own like quirks and stuff. Like there is a long range specialist and coming up with a few new special abilities for commanders that aren't in the original game was a lot of fun. So there's some new stuff there for sure.
I think it's especially bold that you chose to demake a Nintendo game because they are quite litigious. There have been a lot of Zelda and Metroid games that have been taken down over the years. And I'm curious, I'll save you for last. What the developers, are the developers of the original games aware of your creations? Some people actually seek out the original creators' opinions because they're like, this is an homage to what you've done. You've inspired me, and I want you to know that. And sometimes the response to that is not great. So have any of you, save you for last, gotten responses from the original developers, or are you aware that they are aware of it?
So I was really fortunate. They sought me out. I don't know where they saw it, but I think it was when I posted the first build of it to a GB Studio Discord to get some hints on stuff from people. About a week later, someone from the Zaum, the studio that makes Disco Elysium, their marketing team sent me an email and was like, hey, we're putting together a second anniversary press release in 3 months, and we want to put a bunch of fan work into it. And they said, we really like your project. We approve it. Yeah, it was. Yeah, I know. Sorry to everyone else. It was very strange. But now I've got their stamp of approval, which means everything needs to be a little bit more by the book. And also I was like, oh, a lot more people are going to see this now. So I'm not a musician. I had no music in the project at that time. And I had to reach out to someone and go, hey, I need some sound in this that's not just like the worst bleeps and bloops you've ever heard. Can you go in and remake the soundtrack? But the soundtrack is licensed music from another band. So then we had to go to the marketing, and the marketing was like, oh yeah, we need to check with the band that they're okay with us putting this thing out. And it just became a whole different kind of headache, but everyone was okay with it as long as we weren't making any money in the end. So
when you say you have their seal of approval, are they like tweeting about your game or otherwise acknowledging it publicly?
They did, yeah. They've tweeted a couple times and stuff, and like I think it was originally like an email to news outlets and stuff. I remember when they first sent it out, they must have done a marketing release or something with a bunch of different fan projects for the 2-year anniversary. And I think some poor IGN intern, it must have been a slow day and they needed to make 30 minutes of content because they uploaded the first 30 minutes of Disco Elysium Game Boy onto the IGN's main YouTube account. I was like, y'all know this is just a fan thing. This isn't real. It's like you play basically the whole game, but okay, sure.
That is amazing. There is a particular game on the show floor this weekend that looks very much like a Konami game. And I was in line to play it, and the two people in line ahead of me were talking, and one person said, how is this not a copyright violation? And the other person said, probably because Konami doesn't care about their IP anymore. So, Jasper, say
yeah, I literally saw that advertised outside the front, that game that you're talking about, and it was like, it was literally on the poster outside, and I thought, at distance, I thought it was a Konami game, and then I saw it closer, and I was like, okay. Yeah. Yeah, so it really is very close, isn't it?
Is Konami aware of Soundless Mountain?
I did send it through their official channel and never heard back. But I also sent it to Masahiro Ito, who did the art. And he said, oh, that looks really interesting and I'm going to play it. And I never heard back from him. So I don't know, quite honestly, whether he checked it out or not. But I like the idea that he did.
Oh, it's fascinating that you took the initiative of reaching out to Konami. That's kind of like playing a game.
Yeah.
Let's poke the bear and see if it wakes up. And if it doesn't, run away.
Well, I guess because, it was entered into the bootleg D-Makes competition. And so we had to change the name, to make it look like it was a knockoff cart that was just skating around copyright anyway. So all the characters have changed name. He's Jake, he's not James. And
completely different. Okay.
Every line of dialogue is slightly changed, all these sort of things. There's not one line of dialogue that's taken verbatim. All the character names are changed. It's called Soundless Mountain, obviously. that sort of thing. So, I just tried to be very careful about that and, not do anything that could be... So I guess it counts as parody, does it? I don't know, honestly.
And parody is legally protected free speech.
Right, yeah. So technically, I think I might have a leg to stand on should they ever try and care about their IP anymore.
I mean, maybe you could claim that this is what they're remaking this year.
Right. For PS5. Yeah, they might come after me now. I don't know. Yeah.
We're jumping all the way from the 8-bit Nintendo to the PS5.
Yeah. Maybe I should try sending it to Ito-san again and see if he has played it.
I think they should buy this off you, put it in as like an Easter egg. So like right. James Sunderland is walking around Silent Hill, he finds a dilapidated arcade console. He starts playing it at Soundless Mountain 2.
Oh, I'm not going to lie. That would be my dream.
Like, if you could play Outrun in Shenmue, why not play Soundless Mountain 2 in Silent Hill 2?
Yeah. There's that bit in Metal Gear Solid 4 where Snake has a dream and he's back in Metal Gear Solid 1.
Right. Or Day of the Tentacle, where you can play Maniac Mansion on a computer in Day of the Tentacle. I love that.
There's a Call of Duty game where you can play Zork. Like... And Pitfall for the Super Nintendo had Pitfall for the Atari 2600. Mm. I mean, come on. The opportunity is there. The precedent is there. You could be rolling in it. Mm. Come on. All right. So, James, I understand that you took your game that is inspired by a game by Valve, and you uploaded it to Steam, which is run by Valve. How'd that work out for you?
Well, it didn't actually make it to Steam. It was... just a GitHub. I did do it where I just distributed a patch where you didn't download the ROM for me. You had to go grab a file from your Steam installation to generate the patch. Turns out that is actually against the terms of service of Steam. But anyway, so yeah, with in terms of getting permission, so at sometime in December, somebody from Valve reached out to me. He had worked on the original Portal, and he was just telling me that I thought Portal was pretty cool. And by the way, the Portal paradox, you know, where if you drop a piston over a cube and your question is, does it shoot out or does it just stop and then fall? The guy who wrote the original physics for Portal says that it shoots out. So just if there's any question there. But anyway, so I got in contact with them. He loved it. The legal team less so. So I had some back and forth with them, and it took a while to get this figured out. So there are people at Valve who wanted to see this project continue. But ultimately, because I was using LibUltra, which is Nintendo's proprietary library for the N64, they're like, yeah, we don't want to touch that. So they had a can it. And I think even outside of that, I asked if I could use an open source one like LibDragon, and they weren't really on board because I could lose control over the distribution of a ROM because I wasn't distributing on Steam. And I know like a lot of people were taking my ROM and just putting on their phone emulator so they could play Portal on their phone, right? And I feel like the Valve kind of saw that and thought, we don't want to, you know, lose control over and not be able to monitor the distribution of this game. So I think for those reasons, they wanted the project to end.
I think if anything, there's an element of, it sounds to me like your game was actually too accurate and too close to the original game.
Possibly.
So it sounds like Valve didn't want to touch the Nintendo library you were using, but as long as you're distributing it on your own, like, can they really tell you to stop making Portal 64?
I'm no lawyer. So
None of us are.
I figured I'd rather just avoid the liability. I mean, I don't know, maybe I could lawyer up and figure out what I could do legally and see what, you know, where I can actually finish this within like a legal sense, but I don't know if I want to take that leap. So
In all seriousness, where do you go from here? Because you literally worked on this game on and off for years, and if somebody just put a kibosh to it, like I wouldn't just move on to the next project. I would go into a deep funk and be like, what's the point of anything? So where do you go from here?
Yeah, well, I was using that project as an opportunity to grow my YouTube channel, and I also was learning a lot about developing for the console. I was building out physics engines and other assets, and so I'm just taking a lot of the learning and some of the code and porting it over to a new game project that I've started on. So it's still pretty early because I'm now using LibDragon, so I had to rebuild a lot of the core engine that I was using, but I just started on a new project, and I'm hoping that I can use some of the momentum from that to carry over into a new project. So,
and will this also be a demake or be an original IP?
This is an original IP because I don't want to get slapped again.
Sure. Yeah. So this has been a professional development opportunity for you. What about for the rest of you? Why do you do demakes? Like, Colin, you said that this is just a pandemic project for you. So is it just for fun and like by day you're a marine biologist or something?
Well, no. So at the time I was working on it, it was a hobby thing and then also a portfolio piece, but I wasn't a game developer. I was a mechanic actually. And then latest, not immediately after, but a little bit later, I actually did get a game development job afterwards. And I was like, oh yeah, because it's a cool part of my portfolio. And it was, when I got hired, it was one of the most recent things I did. So I'm sure the people who hired me saw it. But then before coming here, I was talking to my boss about it, and he's like, oh, have you done those before? I was like, you hired me. Have you? But yeah, it was another thing. And it was also like, anytime I've worked, tried to start up a project, and like, for me, like, scope creep is just so real. So it was a good way to try and keep things in check and have a small product that I could easily finish and put out there. So, yeah.
Cool. What about you, Jasper? I know that this game, as we said, was made 16 years ago, and you've made a lot of other games since then.
Yeah, why do I make remakes? As I said, it was for the competition, so it wasn't something I'd ever really considered up until that point. I'd never even heard the word used until, Derek, you ran that competition for the Independent Game Source. Yeah, he'd obviously thought about it quite deeply before even coming up with that idea. But I don't know what there was around at that time, 2008. I can't really think of many. It's possible that Derek Gere invented it in some ways, or invented the concept. But I mean, I remember him saying that it was based on the idea of, like, you'd find these clone cartridges and consoles in China or whatever that would have a version of something that was like nearly Street Fighter, but not, you know. And so that's why it was called this sort of bootleg demake thing. So that interested me. It was just a sort of funny concept in a way. Trying to imagine what one of these games where it was a kind of knocked together clone of Street Fighter 2 or whatever, you know, would be like, maybe for a lesser system as well, because I think that was true of it, you know. So games would come out on later systems, and then they would make it for the NES or whatever, like Street Fighter 2 for the NES or something like that, you know. So that part of it interested me. It was funny to in a way, just to kind of picture what they'd be like, because I hadn't actually played them.
Yeah. And what about you, Animal Planet? Why are you doing this? And well, we started off with that. So what I'm asking is, what are you getting out of it now?
Well, now that it's over. it's nice to see people play it. Advance Wars diehard fans that are like just seeking anything on the internet that can keep filling that that hole in their heart for Advance Wars. But what got me into it originally was, it's such a passion project. And the first question you were asking was like, what makes a good game a candidate for a demake? I think any game, any kind of passion project is for it to be a passion project. And it was just something that I was thinking about when I was sleeping, I was thinking about when I was eating, waking, outside, running, whatever. So I think I'm actually missing that in my current project, because which is why I haven't been able to work on it. I can't get a storyline down for it. With Advanced Wars, it was like, I love this game, and I made a new story. There's a prequel for it, so it was so exciting to like get back into the lore and do that. With this game, it's like, what happens? Really, only what's driving me is I'm having fun making the art. I'm having fun exploring the game engine and doing algorithms. But there's like something not gluing it together, and I think that there's a passion part missing. So I think it's really important to have that. Find something that really makes your heart beat, even if it's like, I mean, it's a demake. Ideally, I'd be working on like my own IP and like my own story and be like, this is me. But like, I think that's where my heart was. And I think it creates a lot of value for people, and a lot of people really enjoy that.
Awesome. It's kind of like fan fiction from a software development perspective.
Yeah, I think they're all must. It seems to me like everybody's coming from a place of loving these games, particular games that we've demade a great deal. You know, it's just almost like paying homage to the games that really inspire us, I guess.
Before I go to questions for the audience, I want to point out that there's a huge demake community. Like, this is a small sample of the demakes that are out there. Are there any demakes that inspire any of you or that you want to give a shout out to that aren't your own?
Bloodborne PSX is incredible.
Same.
Yeah. Bloodborne for the PlayStation 1.
Yeah.
So that is a thing. Yeah. Anybody else?
Yeah, I'm sure, well, all of us love that one. I mean, it's quite incredible what she achieved with that game, because she recreated the entire game.
Yeah, it was like, oh, it keeps going. It keeps
boss
going.
Boss fights and everything, you know, and it's quite an incredible project, really inspiring, actually. Yeah. I don't know about too many others. I had obviously heard of a couple of the others on the panel, but... I guess, you know what, I mean, thinking another aspect, I suppose, is the game growing up with home computer systems like the Sinclair Spectrum. We always had terrible arcade conversions, you know, that were much worse than the NES games and things like that. So in a sense, I kind of grew up with demakes, if you like, of arcade games and... You know, because they were terrible. You know, again, like Street Fighter 2 on the Spectrum, which does exist. You know,
you're not being fair to the work you have done, because there's a difference between a demake and a crappy port.
Right. Yeah. Hopefully.
All right. I want to switch to questions and see if this microphone is going to work for me, because now this is the opportunity for you to not line up. You can stay in the comfort of your seats and raise a hand if you have a question. And I see, all right, let's start right here. I saw your hand go up first. Oh, and by the way, a question is a short declarative statement that ends with a question mark.
So, James, you in particular probably mentioned having to use like Nintendo related like code and stuff like that. For the rest of you, did you have to research your target systems, like development software or anything like that?
I mean, I keep saying them. GB Studio is great. Check it out; it's awesome. their guidelines and everything are all. It's like, hey, here's what you can do. You can only have X amount of sprites in one scene, or X amount of characters, and they're always very low numbers. So it was part of the software that I was using was giving me those restrictions and whatnot. So.
Cool.
Yeah, for me, it wasn't anything beyond just the palette and the color palette, really. You know, how many colors does the NES have, and what are they? that was all I really looked into, technically. I didn't try and follow the sound specifications or anything like that.
Yeah. What we need is an N64 Studio app. Just drag and drop, boom, done. Here, have a copy of my magazine. And on the back, there's a Steam code for a random game. Wait, so, any other questions? Let's go back here. Hi there.
Do you think there's any overlap between, like, I guess, the motivation for, like, the demo stuff that comes out of the demo scene and demakes?
Demo scene being the like sort of like the music video tech that people make, right? Or the video game demo scene?
Basic music video tech.
Yeah. Okay.
Or,
okay.
Like, obsolete systems.
Yeah.
Like, video on a 2600 or whatever.
I think a lot of us, we're all coming, like we were saying, about coming from a place of fandom of an original project, where demo scene seems much more interested in the tech engineering aspect of it. I'm not super involved in that, though. I don't know. Yeah, that's all I can say.
Same. Yeah, I don't really, me personally, I can't really speak to that. I don't mm-hmm. have that overlap, I guess.
Oh, interesting. I think other than sharing the same target, as in like older consoles, restricted consoles and spaces, I don't see a ton of overlap. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is some overlap. The person who did the Apple II demakes I mentioned has also entered the demo scene. Hmm. And right here in Boston, there used to be an event called Demo Party that you could go to every year, and people just show off these amazing self-running demos. It's like 16K, and it runs for 2 minutes of audio video on PC, and it's ridiculous. So, yeah, and there are also some great
don't stand in front of a speaker, some great Atari demos. Let's hear from you.
Hi, you mentioned Street Fighter II on the NES. What do you think, how can you tell the difference today between like D-makes made today and like D-makes that were made like on the black market in China and Russia, like Samari the Adventurer or Super Mario World on NES, those games that you would often find on multi-carts or like Soulja Boy consoles, like kind of stuff that YouTuber Rerez talked about.
Yeah, I think it's, well, obviously, the motivation is the main difference, because of those people that were bootlegging those cartridges, they were just trying to somehow trick you into buying what you thought was a better game, you know? Whereas I guess people like us who are doing this sort of thing are trying to do probably the best job that we can within the limitations, if you like.
I also don't want to be like totally dismissive of it though, because some of the times you play those and you're like, this is actually all right.
Yeah.
And I'm like thinking, what if someone remade the most bootleg thing you could find? get a team together, spend a lot of time in it.
Bootleg remakes. Yeah. Yeah. That would be good.
So what, like Cheetah Men 64 or something? So, yeah, that's for you. Cool. Sure. Let's go. I'm right here.
So has there been any game or console that you've been very passionate about wanting to demake onto, but you just, it wasn't really feasible due to the challenge just being too great? Hey, like, you've mentioned the difficulties with porting to your specific consoles already, so I was just curious.
Yeah, actually, I really like the idea of trying to get an open world sized game running on the N64, but then I consider, okay, but then I have to make open world amount of content. And that's really the bottleneck. I'd love to try the tech, but unfortunately one person just can't generate a lot of content, and you're much better off, I think, targeting something that you can make a small slice of that feels complete rather than trying to go really broad. So
Is it, I think it's a Sid Meier quote or something about wanting to make a game that took entirely inside one apartment block or something? This idea of making a very open world but at a very tiny scale and just doing a lot of work still but packing it all into the tiniest amount of physical digital space rather than a big expansive field or whatnot, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. Let's see, I saw a hand, you, sir, with the New York, is that a Yankees hat in Boston? What part of Canada?
Calgary.
That's not Toronto.
No, sorry. Right. Don't give him a no, no.
So I wanted to ask, obviously this stuff comes from a love of these games. You wouldn't make this stuff otherwise. But is there anything about it that it's a little bit like seeing how the sausage gets made? Is there anything that's, you go back to these games and you kind of see through them a little bit? Does it ruin anything for you, or is it just like a positive thing overall?
For me, no. It was such an incredible positive experience, and being able to see like the just tunnel vision-esque, like incredible amount of work that people have done to break down Advanced Wars and have all the facts about, you know, the characters, but also just the battle statistics and all of that. It was, I mean, that's kind of why I got into writing, creating this, to see how that really worked. And it was very fulfilling. No magic lost there.
Mm-hmm. No, same. I think I kind of noticed the little details they added to the game that why they did things. You're like, oh, that makes sense, that they're the little subtle things that they've added that you just wouldn't notice without diving deep into it.
Yeah, it made me just love it even more, and I spent a lot of time just analyzing the pauses, how long fade outs would take, how long you would spend traversing each room, and just looking at all of these timings and things. I feel like I learned so much about editing and timing and kind of pacing of a game just through just analyzing the videos and what, and you know, luckily with Silent Hill 2, there were a bunch of documentaries as well that were made at the time that were really good, that came out with the director's cut. So just rewatching all that stuff just made me even more inspired and love it even more, quite honestly.
Yeah, it's like the thing I was attracted to was like mechanics and systems. So I was already really thinking about how they were working. And then if you really like the music in a game, you can do a cover of it. If you really like the characters, you can do fan art. And it's like, oh, I really love these mechanics and systems, and it's fan art of mechanics and gameplay in a lot of ways.
Yeah, if you like a game soundtrack, go to ocremix.org. They have a lot of great remixes of games. If you like reading about the games you're playing and you want like a more of an academic breakdown, go to Boss Fight Books, many of which are quite good, especially Silent Hill 2 and Metal Gear Solid. Let's go right over here, because you know what Desert Commander is.
Yes, unfortunately, I've been playing games that long. Actually, my question was for Jasper. I wanted to ask, why Silent Hill 2? There's a lot of horror games out, you know, for PlayStation, PlayStation 1. You could have done Resident Evil. You could have done Fatal Frame. You could have done Galarians. You could have done Countdown Vampires.
Well, that's a good shout.
It probably would have been better. but yeah, why Silent Hill 2?
I love Galarians. I love Fatal Frame as well. It's because, I guess, I personally just have a large interest in film, and it was very influenced by film, obviously, that and outside of the game world. So I liked a lot of the source material, I think, that they used to kind of research that game. You know, like the movie Jacob's Ladder or whatever. And so it just connected with me very strongly on that cinematic level. And I guess my dad was a screenwriter, and we used to watch movies together, two a day or something. So it was really just that love of film that I felt within that game. It's probably one reason I also love, Kojima's games or whatever. Yes, yeah.
Awesome, thank you. I think that is the end of our questions, unfortunately, although we'll be hanging out outside the hall at the end. In the last minute, I just want to go down the line. We do have our social media accounts up there, but I want to give you the opportunity to verbally plug your title, where people can find it. All your games are available online for free. Well, they were. So
allegedly.
Just going down the line here, where can people find you?
Yeah, I just have a YouTube channel, James Lambert. That's all.
Yeah, I have a Twitter, Jasper Byrne, it's up there, and also Instagram is Jasper Sonic, because I make music as well, and it's more the music side I put on Insta and TikTok and what have you. So Jasper Sonic or Jasper Byrne on Twitter.
Don't find me. It's fine. You don't have to. You can send me an email or go to csbrand.itch.io to check out Disco Elysium for Game Boy, but I'm okay. Come say hi.
You can find Pico Wars on itch.io/PicoWars. My Twitter X thingy is listed there, LambdaNaut. I don't post there too often, but some game dev stuff goes up there.
Awesome. Thank you all so much for coming to DMX Decoded. Enjoy the rest of PAX.
This has been IndieCider, a GameBits production. Find more episodes, read our blog, or send feedback at IndieCider.net.